Part one of our trip through the Book of Jonah. And first of all, let's just take some time to ask some questions about the book as a whole without getting too much into the story at this stage. That's the sort of outline of the book and our dates for doing it. So it basically is just fortnightly that we're going to be meeting. So tonight, it's basically four chapters, although tonight isn't quite. God's call, first of all, tonight. God's rescue in a fortnight's time. God's mercy, God's heart. And then actually, A, because we've got one more week before Easter, and B, because there is a PS to this story, which is quite important, we're going to spend 1 week at session five looking at the book of Nahum. And we're not going to do that in anything like the detail that we're doing this, but that is kind of the end bit of the story, and will raise, I think, some quite interesting issues for us. And Jonah is a book, I think, which gets more complicated and more interesting as you go through. So what I'm saying is it can only get better after tonight. I think the kind of points of interest of it and so on increase as we go through. So if we are looking at a book from scratch, like we are tonight, I think there are five key questions that we want to ask about the book. Can anyone suggest what some of those questions might be? Okay, so there's something about who. Yep. When. Yep. Why. Excellent.
Where.
Brilliant.
And what?
Okay. Not necessarily in that order. Yeah, so it's good to ask this question. Number one, what sort of a book is it? Because obviously you read it differently if it's poetry compared to if it's narrative or philosophy or whatever. Now, that's the bit that I'm going to duck, because I don't think we'll understand what kind of a book it is, and it's not clear what kind of book it is until we've actually done all of it. So hold that question in your mind. What is this thing that we're studying here? Because there are lots of different theories and understandings about it, and we'll kind of make up our minds, I guess, once we've studied it, once we looked at it. And I have a theory about it, which I've not found in any book, so I'd be interested to see whether I still believe that by the end of it, and whether, if I do, I can convince you. Then there's the who question. And I think there are two who questions, actually. What are the two who questions? So who wrote this book? And who are the characters within it? Okay. Thirdly, when? When does this fit into the big story? Yep. What's the historical setting of it? Where? And one of the things that we've done in the past is drawn like little maps, haven't we, of journeys and so on, and where all that took place. So we've got another one of those coming up tonight, because there is some geography and some travel, obviously, involved in this. And then final question, why? Why is this book in the Bible? What kind of is it meant to teach us? Okay, so let's have a look at those questions. First of all, what we'll do at the end. So, okay, what do we know about who? First of all, who is the protagonist of this, and what do we know about? Jonah. Yep. Jonah, son of Amittai. Mm-hmm. Do we know anything else about him? whether he's a prophet or not. Okay. Well, maybe would someone like to read quickly 2 Kings 14:25, please? There we are. So that's the only other, that there's quite a bit of Jonah in the New Testament, which we'll come to, but for the moment, that's the only other reference to Jonah in the Old Testament. It tells us that he was a prophet, but it also tells us a bit more about him, which we'll come to in a moment. Okay, so that's who the book is about. Who wrote it? Do you get any clues from the text? It's not written in the first person, so it's not an autobiography. So it's written by someone else. Shall I save you your agony? We have absolutely no idea who the author is. We just don't know. But that 2 Kings passage does help us with our second question, which is when. And it's Jonah, we know, is prophesying during the time of Jeroboam II, who was the king of Israel. That was the northern half after they split in half. And we know that he reigned from 782 to 753. So Jonah was an 8th century prophet in the 700s, which would put him alongside people like Amos and Hosea and Micah, other 8th century prophets. And it was not long before the northern kingdom was conquered by Assyria, of which the capital city was
Nineveh.
So there is some topical thing. So we know that the events took place round about 780 to 750 BC, give or take. But that's not the same question as asking when the book was written.
No.
And we don't know who wrote it, but we do know a little bit about the dating of it. First of all, the end point is round about 200 BC, because the book of Ecclesiasticus, which is in the Apocrypha, which is a load of extra books that as Anglicans we don't recognize as being fully in the Bible, whereas Catholics would. But Ecclesiasticus, written about 200 BC in chapter 49, verse 10, talks about the 12 prophets, in other words, the 12 minor prophets that we would recognise in our Bible, and which also are a grouping within the Hebrew Bible. So we know that the book was in existence and circulation before 200 BC. The start point is slightly more difficult, but there are a couple of things which suggest to us that it is post-exilic, so about 500 BC onwards. And all this is quite technical, but the Hebrew of Jonah is quite influenced linguistically by Aramaic, which, of course, by the time of Jesus is the language that everybody spoke. And that only happened after the exile that Aramaic began to come into the language. The second thing is that someone like to jump ahead and just read 3:3 for us, please. Right, that's lovely, but it doesn't make the point I'm wanting to read. And someone with a proper Bible reading. Right, that doesn't either.
Okay, shall I read it?
Yeah.
Jonah obeyed the word of the Lord and went to Nineveh. Now, Nineveh was a very important city, A visit required 3 days.
Okay. Key word there is was, which neither of your ones brought out. In other words, it's past tense.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Nineveh was destroyed in the 5th century. So it must be its recollection past that. And the other thing, we'll talk about Nineveh in a few weeks' time, but a lot of the description of the city could be very inaccurate. I mean, there are ways around that, but, you know, take you 3 days to get across it. I mean, even London wouldn't take you that long to walk across, would it? And so it may be that it's a kind of remembered from the past, slightly exaggerated thing, what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than reflecting the current state of things. So if it is written post-exile, then it can only be a remembrance. The other thing, someone likes to read 3, 7, and 8. There's a couple of social customs there which are hidden in those verses. First of all, Nineveh almost certainly didn't have a king. Any more you'd have a king of Manchester. So that again points to the sort of legendary nature of it. But the decree comes from who? The king and his nobles, and we know from other bits of history that's a late development. Where there were kings before, they would just say, okay, this is it. But the creeping of democracy, I suppose, means that the decrees come from there. And then also the animals joining in the fast and the sackcloth and everything. Again, we know that's quite a late development, and certainly wouldn't have happened in the 8th century when the action of the book is supposed to happen. So it's generally agreed between those two parameters. It probably dates from between 500 and 200. But when we come to the end and I tell you what my theory is about the whole book, that might speak into that a bit and kind of confirm that sort of dating. But I don't think anybody really believes that it was a contemporary account from the 8th century for all those kind of reasons. Right, let's have a look at the geography. Where did all this happen? Well, we've already been told where Jonah came from in that 1 Kings thing. Remember that? Probably not, so I'll tell you, it's Gath Hepher.
Oh, yes.
And Gath Hepher is about 3 miles northeast of Nazareth. So that would tie in with him being a prophet in the northern territory. And I believe, I've not been to Israel, but I believe that you can go to Jonah's grave in Nazareth. If you go and visit that, and he's supposed to be buried there. Okay. So he was told then to go to Nineveh, which is up there. Nineveh is Mosul, which you see on the news in Iraq. It almost is. Mosul's on the one side of the River Tigris, on the west side, so this side of the River Tigris is modern-day Mosul. Across the river is the ruins of what would have been Nineveh. Okay? So that's where he was meant to go. Where did he go instead?
Tarshish.
Before that...
Oh.
Joppa, which is modern-day Jaffa, which was a kind of big seaport down in... It's slightly north of Jerusalem, but it's on the coast there. So, and then to Tarshish. Now, we don't know about Tarshish. There's 2 theories, basically. One is that it's Benidorm. on the Costa, whatever that Costa of Spain is, down there. slightly more likely is a place around there which was called Tartessos, which is modern day Cadiz.
Oh, yes.
So again, a port which a ship would have been likely to go in. We don't know between those possibilities, and there are others, but it hardly matters because he never got there anyway. But the point of the story is the distance that he was told to go is about 500 miles, not 500 metres, 500 miles to Nineveh. So to scale, you can see how far he was. That is some serious running away, isn't it? I think that's the point of that story. I don't think he could have gone much further if he actually tried to. It pretty much is, yes. And you know, if you were telling the story today, you'd say you went to Australia or something like that, and, you know. Now, this is quite interesting. You can have this for nothing, but it has been suggested that that chapter is quite carefully constructed around a particular shape and with a key thing right in the middle of it. So this is how this works, and you can see whether you're convinced by this and whether you think it's clever or not. But the first thing, you got the introductory verses, but you've got a bit of narrative in 4 to 5 about God sending the wind, and there's this motif of fear. All the sailors were afraid, because of the sea. Then you've got the sailor's prayer, each one crying out to
their own gods,
right? Then you've got a little bit more narrative, chucking the cargo over that kind of thing, right? Then you've got the captain's speech in verse 6, where the captain finds Jonah and says, for goodness sake, you know, get up and get praying. Then you've got a bit more of sailor's speech in verse 7, let's cast lots to find out who's responsible for this. We've got a little bit more narrative where they do that, and then the central... then you've got a bit more sailor speech, and then you've got the central thing is Jonah's confession. It's all my fault, folks. And again, you've got this motif of fear coming in 9 and 10. Okay? So that's the first half of the chapter. And then the rest, it's been suggested, is a mirror image of that. So you've got a bit more speech from the sailors, right? Then you've got the narrative in 10. They knew that he was running away. Then you've got a bit more sailors' speech. What should we do to you to make it calm down? Jonah. And then Jonah says, chuck me over. A little bit more narrative in 13, where they try and row and sort it themselves. And then the sailor's prayer, this time to the true God. And then a bit more narrative and the fear again, but this time fear of the Lord. And when you look at that, can you see how it's kind of meant to be a mirror image of each other? So it's very clever. I think what that says about the book, and we often forget this, I think, with biblical stuff, it's a work of art. You know, someone's written this carefully and cleverly. Just like, you know, Shakespeare didn't just dash off stuff on the back of a fag packet. He would have tried to, you know, make it into art. And I think a lot of the biblical stuff has that kind of motif. So as I say, you can have that for nothing, but I thought that was quite
interesting.
It is interesting.
So that's all by way of background, and we kind of set the book a little bit in its historical, geographical setting, and we're going to be agnostic about the nature and purpose of it for now until we've actually looked at it. But let's look at the narrative. And I think there are just three things that are interesting here that I want to let us talk about. Something about Jonah's sin, something about Jonah's sleep, which is interesting, I think, and something about the sailor's faith, which will then lead us on into further discussions. So, Jonah's sin, what do we think it was? Running away, yeah, running away from his assignment, calling into question, as you mentioned earlier, whether he's really worthy of the name of a prophet. Because generally, although, is he the first prophet to run away? Someone did get fed by ravens.
Elijah.
That's right. Interestingly, running away after a great victory on Mount Carmel, which is exactly what we're going to see Jonah doing in chapter 4, but we'll come to that. So prophets do run away. Okay, did they not think that God was everywhere? Yeah. What impression do you get from reading the text on that? Okay, we'll come to that specific point, definitely. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah?
Yes.
Which... maybe God isn't in Benidorm. I think there is a tension through most of the Old Testament, actually. The basic assumption is that it works a bit like the Anglican parish system, and you have a God who is the God over your patch.
Yeah.
And so particularly when they went into exile, there's a real sense that we're getting out of our God's patch, and so we'll have to start praying to Bel and Nebo and all the others because we live in their parish now. And yet you get the other thread running through, I mean, notably some of the Psalms, where can I go from your presence, you know? So I think they were kind of wrestling with that one, really. But clearly, looking at the text as we've got it, yes, he does think he can escape God by going to Benidorm.
Yeah.
You know, have a holiday from God, at least. Yeah, I think certainly his sin is running away. I think there's a little bit more to it than that. Okay, yeah, so there's something about not having that total faith in God to do that. Yeah, say a bit more about that. Yeah, I think there is if you read verse 3, basically, there's quite a lot of detail in there. So to go to Joppa, maybe 75 miles in the opposite direction. So that's, I did it on Google Maps, and it's about 75 miles from Nazareth to Jaffa nowadays. So I guess it was about the same distance in those days, really. So what are you looking at? 3 days' journey there? Something. Then what does he do? He doesn't board it yet. He finds a ship. He buys a ticket. You know, this isn't just a slip up. This is quite deliberate, planned, sustained disobedience to God and to his calling. Yep. Now, having said that, what would you do if God suddenly appeared to you and said, I want you to go and preach in the city of Moscow? So let's not be too hard. And we'll see when we get to chapter 3. We'll see just what an absolutely terrifying call that was. And it isn't like, you know, God says, oh, I want you to go and do something and you kind of don't get around to it or whatever. This is a terrifying call, way outside his comfort zone. No, he probably didn't have the faith to believe it would make the slightest bit of difference. If you just turned up in Moscow and walked a day's journey into the city centre and started preaching on the street corners, You know, I mean, what language do you preach in apart from anything else? It was, we'll see about that, but I mean, it was just dreadful. Renowned for their violence. I mean, probably a closer equivalent would be going preaching Baghdad or something. So for all the deliberate planned sustained disobedience, we can kind of understand it, because we probably have done exactly the same. So what's God's response to Jonah's sin? He sends the storm. Now, do we think that's fair on the sailors and the people whose cargo they chucked overboard? But do we feel slightly sorry for the poor old sailors? We're going to see in a minute there's a superstition So if, I mean, it could be argued, I suppose, that the sailors ended up coming to God, coming to the true God, so therefore it was all worth it. But at this stage, they're absolutely terrified. They're in fear of their lives. Someone's stuff has been chucked into the sea. What's the take home from that, do you think? I think that's a really important point for an individualistic society where we believe that we've got the divine right to do whatever, and if it hurts us, well, that's a shame, but never mind anybody else, you know? And I think what this is saying to us is that when we disobey God, there is the possibility that other people will get hurt by that. And in some ways that's obvious, you know, if I have 10 pints and then drive home and then kill someone, my sin has harmed someone else, someone else's family. And it's always good to remember that, I think, because that is so countercultural to think that, you know, the way we live does affect others. And the other side of that, I remember a sermon from my youth, and that it was when I was in the Baptist church, and they used to have a text. My text for tonight is, and it was something, I can't remember the chapter now, but it's in Mark's Gospel, and my text for tonight is, "And there were other ships with them." And actually it's the narrative of the stilling of the storm. And Mark, I think just Mark, tells us that there were other boats out on the sea at the time. So when Jesus comes and stills the storm, they feel the benefit. And the take home of that was that when a community is experiencing the power of Jesus, then others around feel the benefit. And that's what we're trying to do at St. Swithin's, isn't it, in the city centre, you know, in all sorts of little ways, because God is there. Not that he wasn't before St. Swithin's came, but you know what I mean, because God is there and active and doing stuff, that ripples out, it ripples into the prison, it ripples to homeless guys on the street, it ripples to people who use the clothing bank and so on. But this passage, I think, gives us the other side of that, that when we're disobeying God, when we're trying to run away, others might get hurt by that. We'll come to that in a moment, but there's something, I mean, all's well that ends well, in a sense, and it was your cargo that went over. We've got some friends, and I just saw on Facebook today, I didn't know this, but they're obviously moving to New Zealand, because they had a little map on live tracking the progress of the container with all their worldly goods in. So I'm just thinking, you know, some prophet is on that ship going to New Zealand, disobeys God, they're going to lose all their stuff over the edge. You know, I don't know if it works like that nowadays, but... So there's something quite important there, I think, isn't there, about the nature of sin and disobedience. What about Jonah's sleep? What do you make of that little motif? I think that's how I read it.
Is it?
You know, yeah. as they pull out of the harbour. Like we used to feel on the day off, you know, if we nipped over to front when we were in Folkestone, if we nipped over. So, as soon as you go under that tunnel, you think, out the parish. Any other observations on that motif?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Storm.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. What's the difference between Jonah's sleep and Jesus' sleep? Yeah, I mean, Jesus is the sleep of absolute peace and dependence on his Father. Jonah's is the sleep of, oh, thank goodness I've got away from. We're going to find, as we go through this book, more Jesus-Jonah parallels. But I think this is the first one, and I don't know whether the gospel writers wrote the storm narrative with Jonah in the back. Well, they must have written the storm narrative with Jonah in the back of their mind, and has Jesus asleep during the storm, but a very different sleep because he's going to sort it. We'll come back to that. It's all part of my theory. I also like, finally, well, I don't like, but I think it's quite clever, the picture of Jonah happily snoring away whilst the sailors are absolutely going mental and frantic. And I think you've got a picture of the church there very often. You know, we're happily doing our own bits and not letting God get too close, and all around us there are people absolutely frantic and desperate. And we're just dozing away, doing our services and having our jumble sales and all that kind of stuff. So I quite like that little motif. Let's end by just having a little look at the sailors' faith in this story. And I think that there's quite an interesting study here, and quite a few insights into the faith of non-Christians. And especially blokes, I think. We don't know who else was on the ship, but the image you get of sailors is a particular image which probably hasn't changed much over the centuries. And we've already mentioned that a little bit. Just have a look through the story and tell me what you see these people doing as the narrative progresses. That's a slightly obscure question, but I think you'll get the hang of it once we get going. What's the first thing we see the sailors doing? I think you've got, I mean, obviously I've got this on the PowerPoint in particular order, and I think you've got the first two there. I think, first of all, you've got that mixture of prayer and superstition in a crisis. And it's often said that everybody prays in a crisis. I remember the figures a few years back that came out that said 75% of people in Britain pray. And then put that next to the figures that 50% say they're atheists. So what are the 25% overlap praying to? And there is something, I think, still in our secularised age, which in a moment of crisis looks for something or someone to pray for. But often in an uninformed way, so they're each praying to their own particular deity, and like many crews nowadays, there would probably be a mixed nationality crew. So there's that mixture of superstition and faith, but nevertheless the desire to call out to something. And then a typical bloke attitude, we can do this. You know, we men are problem solvers. That's why if you women come to us in tears and all you want is a hug and they're there, what we'll do is we'll try and fix it for you. And it's not what you want at all, but there's something within the bloke's makeup, I think, which I use the word makeup in a psychological sense, that we are problem solvers and fixers and so on. Which is why, personally, I find all this gender confusion stuff quite difficult, because I think there are clearly blokes and women, and they're different as God created them to be in so many ways, you know. And so if the crew had been made up of women, I suspect that the result here would have been quite difficult. They'd have all sat down and had coffee and talked about it, or got the Prosecco out or something. Whereas the men's like, come on then, let's get this
overboard.
Yeah, chuck the Prosecco stores overboard. And the gin. What's the next reaction after that, when that doesn't work? The prayer to their gods doesn't work. The throwing the cargo over doesn't work. What's their next stage? Yeah. Whose fault is this? Who can we blame for this? This isn't just a chance freak weather thing. Maybe it was of a completely different magnitude to anything that they experienced. That's how the text presents it, doesn't it?
It says hurricane, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it does seem to escalate. You get the sense, don't you, that the storm, the more they do, the worse the storm gets, which of course is what you want for, if you were God, to kind of get their attention. So then they decide that it's someone's fault, and how can we sort that out? And then this drawing lots thing, again, another superstitious kind of practice to do that. And then comes the turning point in that narrative, which is, I said, Jonah's confession. It's all down to me, lads. Chuck me in the sea and it'll all be all right. Be running away to that much sea wasn't the best idea. So he tells them to chuck him into the sea. What's their reaction to that?
They rowed hard.
Yeah, oh, come on, we don't want to do that. You know, they're basically kind of good-natured. There must be another way to sort this. There must be another way to solve it. We don't want to just chuck you over. And they don't want to do that, and so what do? They try harder, which again is another bloke thing. If something doesn't work, you just do it a bit harder in the hope that it will, rather than saying, this isn't working, is there another way of looking at this, you know? So then they do actually chuck him over, somewhat reluctantly, you think, in verse 15, and immediately
It all
comes down. Their reaction, and they turn to God. There's suddenly prayer to the right God. They see this as a result, and are they converted? The text certainly says that, doesn't it? And you get a lot of that in the Old Testament, don't you? I mean, we talked about the story of Naaman, where the leper who gets healed and his reaction is to worship God, the true God, and that's not the only thing of that you get. Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to see that kind of motif again when we do finally get to Nineveh. Let's talk about the fear of God. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Okay, are there different kinds of fear of God? And in the Old Testament, is it a bit more kind of visceral and fear in the sense of, if I don't, he will smite me in some way? And does that become in the New Testament awe and wonder at God? What do we think about that? Does God say good if we're afraid of him in that same sense as the head teacher would? You think it's
again,
right?
Well,
So Jesus is the nice one.
Jesus is
and the Father is the one.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
Jesus yeah. is kind of standing in the way of the wrathful Father.
So that when...
I think I'm slightly concerned about the idea of the persons of the Trinity working against each other. But isn't Jesus alongside us to bring all the love of the Father? Rather than alongside us to, because God's distant and a little bit nasty at times. So has God changed since? I think that's a popularly held idea. I'm not convinced I buy it personally.
No.
Let's have a look. We've got on something important here, haven't we? What is fear, essentially? And I think it is, if I do so-and-so, something nasty will happen to me. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
At the bottom line.
All right.
If I am a naughty boy, the headmaster will whack me, or could have done in the old days, and that will hurt. That kind of thing. So the fear of God is... if I disobey God, something nasty will happen to me. Is that a bad thing? I think that the single biggest thing that is wrong with society nowadays is that we have lost the fear of God. And I think if we really believed that if we lived in certain ways, we would have a God to answer to, I think we'd stop it. You know, drug dealers, sex traffickers, exiteers, you know. sorry, letting my political bias show there. But do you know what I mean? And the fact of the matter is that most people nowadays think they can live exactly as they like without any consequences, repercussions or eternal consequences. So that is like... that is like, headmaster, he's not going to do anything. I'm watching one of my favourite series at the moment on telly, and they've arrested this 14-year-old boy who they think has murdered someone. And he's typical, he's been grilled by the police, and he's just sitting there, wives, you know, just not. And it's that kind of attitude. And it's that kind of attitude our society has to God. And if you read Romans chapter 1, which is where Paul is setting out why the gospel is needed, his fundamental root problem, as far as he's concerned, is that we don't respect or thank God, and we just think we can do whatever we like. So I'm actually quite keen on the fear of God, and I'm not convinced there is... I don't think it works differently in the Old Testament than the New Testament. I think the fear of God is an appropriate reaction for those who are against him. For those who are with him, his favour replaces fear. And there's loads in the New Testament, fear not. Don't be afraid. Perfect love casts out fear. That's always addressed to those who are God's people. And the Christmas thing, you know, the angels. Don't be afraid. I'll bring good news of great joy for those on whom God's favour rests. I'm not sure. When they go out, they say, the kingdom of God has come near you. Yeah, and some people join in with that. But if they won't accept you, shake the dust from off your feet and say to them, the kingdom of God has come near you. And I think there's a slightly different tone of voice there. You've had your chance and you've chosen to. So be very afraid. I think fear, you know, one of the reasons I don't do 120 up the A1 is because I'm scared stiff that I'll get a pull.
Yeah.
Or have an accident. Yeah. Fear is a good thing. Ananias and Sapphira and Jesus teaching on hell. Jesus teaches far more on hell than he does on heaven, for example. I think God's, we'll talk about this later on in a few weeks' time, but I think God is not in a hurry. I think he, in the Old Testament, it can sometimes seem a bit instantaneous.
Yeah.
And I think we'll see, God leaves things as long as he possibly can in the hope that people might turn to him. But anyway, we probably need to wind that up. There's some quite interesting stuff that's come out of that, hasn't it? It's made us think a bit. So.